Hello, Randall Paul. It's delightful to hear your voice, my friend.
Likewise, Mark. How have you been?
I've been well. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Well, it's really good to have you. Everyone who's listening, Charles Randall Paul is a good friend that I don't speak to often. I think that's a fair description, right?
Yeah, we don't speak often enough, that's for sure.
Don't speak often enough. And Randall and I did two important dialogues that actually are on the markgoffney.com website. At least one of them is. And they'll appear in future works on betrayal about 4 or 5 years ago. That's how we originally met, through our mutual friend John Kessler back in the day. And we've actually found our way, as we've evolved into our respective public works, into a very deeply related area in very, very different ways. You know, both, you know, Charles and I are deeply interested in kind of the broader context, which lives not only, you know, in our faith, but beyond our faith. And I live and was trained as an Orthodox Jew. Right? I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. I still essentially practice Orthodox. And yet I affiliate and kind of live in a context which we've called world spirituality. And the Center for World Spirituality, together with, you know, my leading voice friend Ken Wilber and 80 different spiritual leaders from around the world on the Wisdom Council, are working to articulate what might be the vision of a trans-traditional path, a path beyond the traditions, which speaks to people who, A, no longer can locate themselves in the traditions, and B, to people who feel like they might be dual citizens, meaning they're passionate members of one tradition and yet live not only in their tradition but beyond their tradition as members of the global community of spirituality as well. So that's our context. And if I can introduce everyone to Charles Randall Paul. Charles, besides being a highly articulate, educated, insightful man of spirit, he actually did his degree, right, his MBA is from Harvard University. He worked for many years, right, actively in business as a partner in Trammell Crow Company in the southwestern United States, and he was a developer of commercial real estate. And then he went on to do his PhD at University of Chicago and wrote a dissertation on religious and cultural conflict, right, under the supervision of David Tracy, Martin Marty and Harold Bloom at Yale. And Harold Bloom is a well-known cultural critic. David Tracy has written some of the most important works on the contemporary spirituality beyond the traditions. And then Randall went on to found and to president the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy, which aims to build trust between people who advocate different religious and ideological paths in very, very dramatic ways. And it's, you know, the Foundation is really developing a network of what you call, Charles, religiously bilingual diplomats, who are
yes,
both
really,
committed.
Yes, that really meshes very nicely with your idea of being firmly
dual
in
citizen.
One tradition and yet being a citizen that can truly have a deep understanding of a tradition outside of one's own.
Well, actually, Randall, I think that you are, you know, actually, you know, in a certain sense, the archetype model of what we call a dual citizen. And if I can share one more minute but with everyone else before turning over to you and setting up our topic, which is unique self. Our topic this evening is unique self and what we're calling unique self-enlightenment. But before we get there, you know, you're really an expression of, in a very passionate way and in a very sophisticated way, being a dual citizen. You know, Randall is a committed Mormon. I think that's fair to say. You're not a Jack Mormon. You're deeply committed to the faith.
No,
you're deeply...
that's right. I'm a card-carrying Mormon. I've been a Mormon bishop, and you know, I'm
right.
Very active in the church.
Right. So Randall's active in the church, bishop in the church, you know, deep believer in the faith. And at the same time, you couldn't say that Randall's fully defined only by Mormonism in the sense that he doesn't also live in a much larger cultural spiritual context, but not one which conflicts with his faith, but one which is living side by side with his faith, you know, and in that sense you're bilingual, you're a dual citizen. And you've started a foundation which is really about people who are living in their faith passionately, learning how to passionately disagree with people of other faiths, right, in forthright contestation, as you call it, right, the old religious context, but in a different higher context, even as they also work together to cooperate in the place where they can really share in common humanitarian service and the like. Is that a fair introduction?
That's really a great introduction. I think a friend of mine a few months ago said, after he had an experience with a friend of his dealing over a very difficult question of whether they could be friends and take two different sides of the Prop 8 issue in California. At that moment, they looked at each other, and the question between them was, can we remain friends and have the deep convictions we have that are apart? And in a matter of seconds, they looked at each other and realized that they were both tearing up. That was a nonverbal moment where they said to themselves, this must be, we must remain friends. This is what we want more than anything else. And as my friend later described the experience, he came back and said, Randall, what you're doing with your foundation work is trying to get people to that moment, that impossible moment. And at that impossible moment, they will find within themselves what he called a spiritual aphrodisiac, a moment that is unlike any other they've had before, where they realize they love each other in the face of these irreconcilable differences. And so it's that kind of experience I want to bring people to in these deep conversations, where they get to the, as the Greek would call it, the aporia, the untiable knot, the thing that can't be reconciled. What do they do from there? Do they shun each other? Do they diss each other? Or do they embrace each other? And that's what we're all about. We're trying to get people to that nonverbal moment of embrace.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. Gorgeous. Well, thank you very, very much. And we'll talk in a separate dialogue really about what you're doing, you know, in a very deep way, kind of practically. But for now, our next, you know, half hour, 40 minutes or so, we're here to talk about Unique Self. And
I'm very excited
to share with you that the Unique Self book, Your Unique Self, The Future of Enlightenment, has just come out. Integral Publishing, right? It's very, very exciting. It's a great elite publishing firm, right, in the integral world. But of course, it's aimed not at the integral world per se, but at the broadest possible audience. And I want to spend maybe a minute or two just sharing the core Unique Self idea with you, and then let's go back and forth and let's really kind of talk about this in a deep way, you know, both within the Mormon context and the broader spiritual context. So
let's do it.
For me, Randall, Unique Self is possibly the single most important idea we can articulate in order to claim, right, enlightenment, right, as a genuine possibility. And let me kind of say what I mean very briefly. Enlightenment is the basic understanding of all the great traditions, that I can actually understand myself in a larger context than being merely a tortured, contracted, skin-encapsulated ego. That I can actually understand that I am part of the larger, seamless code of the universe, or that I am in relationship to, right, the ultimate. I'm in relationship to Source, and in a fully enlightened sense, I'm actually living as Source. I'm actually an incarnation, right, of Source. Now, in the normal understanding, right, when I actually realize I'm an incarnation of Source, I leave behind my sense of being separate. Right? I leave behind my sense of being, you know, individuated. My individuated sense, that's my egoic sense. But the goal is said to be evolution beyond ego, beyond my sense of ego as a sense of a separate self individual. I have to evolve beyond ego and realize that I'm true self, that I'm part of the true self. And essentially, that's been the classical enlightenment tradition in all the great mystical traditions, East and West. You know, it's especially strong in Advaita Vedanta and Hinduism and Buddhism, but it's also strong in mystical Christianity. It's strong in Hasidism and Judaism. Right? It's the sense that you've got to realize, you know, one. Right? There's a big Kabbalah conference now called The One. Right? I'm part of The One. And although I still function as a separate self in the world, but in my truly enlightened sense, I realize, well, I'm part of the one. I leave my sense of, you know, separate uniqueness behind. As a matter of fact, one spiritual teacher was famously quoted for saying, there's no such thing as a unique spiritual experience. And that's been the major teaching from the East and the mystical traditions. And essentially, what I'm saying in Unique Self, emergent out of a deep lineage stream, right, both in Sufism, right, in Kabbalah, and based on deep modern understandings of individuality and postmodern understandings of perspective. That's a big set of words there. But based on all of those, we've brought together this very, very deep teaching of Unique Self, which says in a word, yes, I'm part of the seamless code of the universe. Yes, I've got to break through separate self and realize that I am actually true self, but true self always sees through a unique set of eyes. True self never, right, is absorbed into the one, right, in a way in which uniqueness is lost. Separateness is left behind. I'm no longer separate, but I'm actually a unique expression of all that is. I'm actually an incarnation of irreducible uniqueness. I'm actually the personal face of essence. And to actually access a fully incarnate enlightenment, I don't need to do, as most teachers say, move beyond the personal to the impersonal. No, I've got to get to the third level. There's kind of level one personal, which is kind of personality, the egoic grasping of personality, which is important. And personality has all the flavors that it does, and I function with it in the world. I need to function in that, then move beyond it, realize, no, I'm not just that. I actually realize myself as true self. I'm actually part of the spacious, seamless code of the universe. I'm part of the very ground of being, right? Source, right, lives, right? I live as source, right? That's my true self. That's the impersonal. That's impersonal. But I actually need to get to level three. And level three is when I realize that the impersonal then re-expresses itself personally, personally through me, through my unique face, through my unique set of eyes. Right? And actually to love God is to let God see through my eyes. Right? To love God is to know, right, that actually God is having a Randall experience. God's having,
yes,
a Mark experience. God,
yes,
lives, right, in me, as me, and through me, as the personal face of essence, and therefore my enlightenment is to move beyond my separateness, but to embrace, at the higher level personal, my radical uniqueness. So that's in a word, that's the excitement that we feel around unique self, and it actually begins to, for the first time, invite people back to the enlightenment conversation, because, and this is my last sentence, and I turn it over to you, my friend, in the enlightenment conversation, you know, the reason it hasn't taken in the world, and it really hasn't, enlightenment's remained a fringe conversation, is because people have this intuitive sense, well, if I'm enlightened, I'm part of the one, then where am I? I get lost. And so the teacher says, well, no, that's just your ego talking. But the person feels, well, no, there's something more essential. You're asking me to actually give up my unique specialness, and although I'm willing to give up my unique specialness to the level of ego, but I feel there's something deeper than that, and I don't want to give that up. And the teacher says, no, that's your ego. And the person feels like it's not. And so the modern and postmodern communities have really rejected enlightenment. And unique self allows us for the first time, right, to reclaim enlightenment as a genuine possibility, to live fully unique as part of the one. That's the excitement. That's where we're going. And my sense is that this is an essential building block in an emergent world spirituality. Turn it to you, Charles Randall Paul.
Well, that was... I think a wonderful, what you might call 21st century synthesis of the Eastern and the Western way. If you look at the Eastern way, you've well described it, I think, as an overlaying Brahman idea that there is something that is one beyond all and that everything that is partial is less than the whole, less than in both size, but also in some sense importance or truth or comprehensiveness that matters, i.e. the part is unenlightened compared to the whole. And what you've done with this synthesis, it seems to me, is saying, I think Alfred North Whitehead would, with his process thought, would have agreed with you on this, because he tried to work with some kind of a synthesis of Buddhism in its deepest conceptions and Western individualism. You have made the synthesis work by saying the whole is not more than the part, and because it only understands the whole through parts. That's the only way the whole or the all is interesting, is through parts. There's no amalgamated summation that is particularly better than any particular aspect of it in in what you're pushing for here. I know that I'm grasping at what you're saying and not nailing it, but I'm trying to get to this synthesis that is that allows the person to go into the ashram or to the church or to wherever and say, I don't have to trash myself, my unique self, nor my unique loving relationships. I don't have to disengage. My desire, my love, is not what the Buddha wanted me to trash. It wasn't that aspect of attachment that he wanted me to trash, if you will. And so you're trying to create a synthesis that allows for this passionate attachment that is done with awareness, that is done in a positive way, that elevates love as something that isn't something that will ultimately be disappointing, which is the problem with all desireful behaviors in the Eastern world. They ultimately disappoint, and therefore there's only suffering behind desire. You seem to be saying, no, the unique self is a desiring entity, and it is going to be part of the future too. It is part of the future. It is not something that has to be eliminated. The interesting thing then becomes with your program, how do you retrieve this idea of unattachedness in a sense that gives weight to it too in the future? I want to engage in a dialogue where you can explain to me how you have not effectively trumped the Eastern way by saying unique self is higher than the total self. That the total of all beings is not anything but an amalgam of the particular. And therefore, the Buddha was, shall we say, mistaken in the enlightenment that said the whole problem is desire and attachment. Help me with that critique. Bring back the Eastern way in this and show me what you view in this new vision unattachment is. And I'll shut up and leave it back to you.
No, that's great. I mean, Randall, the reason it's so great to dialogue with you is because, you know, every response of yours is always, you know, kind of precise, insightful, and always opens up the space that needs to be opened up. So I'm delighted by your comments. So first, three things. First, you completely correctly intuit that this is a higher embrace. It's a higher, if you will, integral embrace in the broadest sense of the word integral of East and West. And, you know, the general position that we're operating with is that, you know, no one's smart enough, right, to be entirely wrong, right? So every great system...
I love that.
You know, every great system, right, you know, has its, you know, its deep understanding that is true but partial, right? So what's the East's great understanding? The great understanding of the East is that to move beyond suffering, you need to move beyond your identity as a separate self. It's a fantastic understanding. Your identity as a separate self, right, which is the grasping, you know, desiring, attached, egoic structure, right, the skandhas, right, are the source of suffering. So you got to move beyond your separate self to the true self. That's one understanding, right? But then you go to the West, and that's called Eastern Enlightenment. But the West also has its notion of enlightenment. And the Western notion of enlightenment is not about a state experience of enlightenment, right, where you actually experience yourself as part of the one, but it's about a structure stage of consciousness. The Western Enlightenment, right, means actually a structure stage of consciousness, which happens around the French Revolution at a particular point in time, and when people begin to realize that their dignity and their value is actually rooted in being a separate self. Right, it's the emergence of the individual. Right, so paradoxically, right, the Western word enlightenment refers to a structure stage, a level of consciousness in which the individual emerges as the source of his or her own dignity and value. And while the Eastern enlightenment is about moving beyond being a separate self, a separate individual, right, in order to overcome suffering. And, of course, the Western enlightenment is also about overcoming suffering. Same thing. How do you overcome suffering? You overcome suffering by actually affirming the dignity of the separate self individual.
So to say the suffering was worth it somehow, right?
Well, no,
somehow it's worth it.
The West says that, or Well, let me say differently. The West says historically, suffering comes from the human being a cog, and their identity coming from only a larger context, from the state, from the church. But actually, like the word self, Randall, only appears in the dictionary the first time in the Renaissance. So
yeah.
It's the emergence of the individual is the beginning of progress away from the old suffering of the medieval and pre-medieval period. So what we're saying is, well, that's great. So the West has this great intuition, right, the dignity of separate self, right, which is actually, which derives from a person's uniqueness, right? And that's the way you got to overcome suffering to really affirm that. The East has a great intuition. No, if you're stuck in your separate self, you're stuck in your skandhas and your ego and your grasping, you got to move beyond that and be true self. What we're saying is that actually both sides made a little bit of a mistake. Both of them confused separateness and uniqueness. And that when the East said move beyond separate self, they kind of threw in uniqueness. They kind of gave up uniqueness. They didn't need to. You can move beyond your separate self, be part of the one, the large one, and yet an irreducible unique expression of the one. So you can move beyond separate self and still retain complete unique self. The West, when it said, no, you gotta retain, you know, profound individuality, separate self individuality, because all the goods, right, of Western enlightenment come from accountability, responsibility, relationship, human dignity, individual rights. The West made a mistake also. And it was the same mistake on the other side of the street, the confusion between separateness and uniqueness. Because actually, in order to maintain the goods of the Western enlightenment, you don't need to be a separate self, you need to be a unique self. In other words, we can actually acknowledge the Eastern mystical intuition as being completely correct. You and I can be both part of the one together and yet utterly unique expressions of the one. We don't need to be separate, we need to be unique. So that allows us, it's devastatingly beautiful, it completely evolves the whole conversation.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
I think it's extremely exciting. I'm going to push back only in one historical element
please,
of your analysis,
please.
And that is that I do believe that when you look at the Enlightenment, Western Enlightenment, the French, les philosophes, really it was a secular attempt to face the idea of individual salvation that was actually derived out of Hebrew and eventually Christian thought, that an individual is saved, that there's an individual final judgment. And that individuation well preceded, came all the way through the Middle Ages. And it was there, and it was in its fullest format, I think, in Christianity. You get the notion of it possible in ancient Judaism, but there is the collective salvation. You get the idea the tribe is, you're saved as a tribe, so to speak, in ancient, in the earlier Semitic forms. But certainly in Christianity, it comes out that way. So that's the only little pushback I'd push on you there. I would not throw it all on the French philosophers to come up with this idea of
I think that's completely right, Randall. I mean, I would actually root individuality ultimately, you know, in homo imago Dei, you know, in the human being created as a unique image of divinity, right? And in actually the Talmudic sources, 3rd century, right, the notion of homo imago Dei, of being actually created in the divine image, is explained by the Talmud as just as their faces are unique, so too are their essences unique. Right?
Uh-huh.
Having said that, so I completely agree there's a strong proto-uniqueness idea that's already present, but having said that, you still don't have the idea, right, that a person...
It ended with existentialism, with this absolute separateness of, as Sartre said, we are corks bobbling on the sea. We bump into each other, maybe, from time to time, but that's the extent of our relatedness. That was where the West went astray.
That is where the West for sure went astray. I'm completely with you on that. I think it's also true, though, to say that neither Judaism nor Christianity actually gave dignity to the individual qua individual, right, without them being located in a particular religious context, right?
That's true.
Because remember,
that is true.
You know, in other words, so you still, it wasn't that your individuality per se was self-validating. You were actually only an individual, right, of value if you, for example, accepted Christ, if you were part of the community of Israel.
If you were
what
part
the Renaissance
of the community,
did was,
that's true. That's true.
The Renaissance went the next step.
Yes, I think you're right there. But the Renaissance did go to the next step, and ultimately it went, as we just said,
it went back.
A radical step, and that's why the world we're in today, at least the modern world, is saying, "Where's the community? We've lost the community," right?
Right. James Putnam, bowling alone.
Bowling
right.
alone.
We're bowling alone. Yeah, we're bowling alone. We're both. How would unique self play, right, as a key factor, for example, in any of the work that you do, in any of the ways you play? How does this kind of new structure of thought begin to become alive for you?
Well, I'll talk to you theoretically about it in the work of my own work, and then we'll talk a little bit, maybe if we've got some time, about Mormonism, and then we'll talk a little bit about this practical work I do. But theoretically,
awesome.
I think the work of William James later in his life, where he wrote The Pluralistic Universe, pushed to the hilt the idea of radical difference, never reconciled, never harmonized. It's William James in his last years who came up effectively with this multiple universes idea,
mm-hmm.
theoretically, that who says everything has to be somehow harmonized and connected? You know, that he would have called that an aesthetic proclivity toward oneness that some of us have, and that we push it into our religious thought or into our philosophical thought. But we begin with that aesthetic feeling that the one is required, that unity is required. James said, not so fast. What if I tell you I find it aesthetically appealing for ultimate divergence, for there being a gap between persons? That's my aesthetic take on the way things are, ultimately. And he basically said that this is a metaphysical claim that will, in the sweet by and by, perhaps become more evident that he is wrong about his radical pluralism, and that there is a one, or that the one turns out to be incorrect as a description of ultimate reality. He always left the metaphysical claim open to more experience. So he wasn't ever making a final claim. He was only asking the question of why we are so sure now about our ultimate claims with respect to this whole issue that we're talking about of going to what you call the third step and making this vision of the plural and the union somehow work together. So if anything I say is a critique of everything you're doing, it would be go back to William James and look at his critique and say, all this is tentative. You still haven't convinced me. I'm speaking as William James. I still haven't convinced myself that
mm-hmm.
one particular form of reality is the most real. But James would also say, we do not have the luxury as human beings of pretending to be tentative. We live as if one of these things is true. We prove by how we live, we act every day, that we are either monists or convergentists, as he would say, or pluralists and divergentists. That's the way we tend to live our lives and have our philosophies and pray our prayers. So with that back, that big rubric of answering your question as a background, a Jamesian background, I'll say that I'm tentative about what I'm about to say, but I live as if it's true, as if I believe it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I live as if I believe that there is some radical relatedness that is mysterious, that has always been the case. I go, therefore, in an eastern direction toward an eternity, a retrogressive eternity where there was never a beginning. I tend to move in that direction of thought to say there has always been plurality, there's always been relatedness, and there's always been change. And so I take what you would call the unique self as a self with infinite past always related to other selves who had infinite pasts. And those relationships, since they're infinite, I don't even ask the question of beginnings. I just say, okay, where are we now? And what do we do with this now? How do I want, I desire, how does my unique history that comes out of gazillions of influences of relationships in the past, how does what I am that is totally related to everything else in the past, how does this in unique self now desire influence from other unique selves? What I find the most interesting question today, as you'll find in what I'm doing, is not the question of are we related or can we be related or are we unique or can we be unique, but my interesting question is, who do I want to influence me today? And who do I want to influence today? The idea of influence, to me, is the most interesting modern or contemporary question in the world. What do we do now that we realize we're unique selves? What is our desire? Who do we choose to influence and who do we want to influence us? To me, that idea, that's a Jamesian idea of selection. He says always, you know, how do you select? What do you look at when you're looking across the room? You look at this book and not that book. Why? You look at this person, not that book, person. Why? The very fact that you chose to talk to me today, I take that as an enormous gift, because you could have talked to literally thousands of other people for an hour. But you chose to invite my influence into your life. And I chose to invite your influence into my life. And we will be different because of this. The unique self is no longer going to be what it was an hour from now because I talked with Mark Gaffney. And to me, that gives such excitement to every day of my life, even on downers. If I've got an opponent, I'm going into a lawsuit, I kind of laugh to myself and say, well, I've chosen to have this opposing attorney influence me today. How do I want to influence him or her? It brings you together in this oneness, but never requiring the umbrella above. The oneness is always in what Immanuel Levinas, who is my kind of my favorite modern philosopher, would call the face to face.
Right.
Where he and when you literally look in the eyes of another person. Some people would say another sentient being or animal or even a plant, but I'll stick with persons. I've always been a mystical sloth. I've never quite gotten there. But anyhow, you see where I'm going. I don't need the umbrella. I don't need the overglue. I can just you on the phone is enough for me to say, wow, I am more than me. That's for sure. And therefore.
Yeah.
I really find that what I'm doing in my work is bringing people, regardless of their ultimate metaphysical claims about oneness or separateness, to just the experience of the face-to-face. That's enough oneness. Two people, if you will, in a new relationship is enough oneness to crack the universe wide open. It really is.
Yeah.
Because you find in that moment when you really do sense that this other person is influencing you deeply. You know it. It's happening. And it usually comes from a feeling that you feel trust and love from that person, even in some sense. It can be erotic in the sense of an attraction, but it can also be erotic in the sense of pushing you to desire more from that person, to desire more. I'm rattling on here, but what I'm getting at is...
No, it's good.
...that the you don't have to go into a meditative state to create a feeling of oneness. You can do it in a very tactile, open moment by looking in the eyes, or if you're blind, feeling the presence of another human being. And so that's and that unique self is found. By the way, the unique self is found in that moment of relation. That's
right.
That's what I'm
beautiful.
Getting
that's
at
beautiful.
Here. It's
beautiful,
never
beautiful. No,
it's what René Girard, you're now in his territory, he's at Stanford, René Girard would call, he would say where the West, to use your critique earlier, he'd say where the West screwed up, where the Western Enlightenment screwed up is with the very notion of the individual. He said, they missed it. We are actually interdividuals. Interdividuals,
right, right,
is his word.
That's so great, Randall. And let me just really, really just, I mean, just that was a very, very eloquent unfolding. And so let me, if with your permission, you know, just kind of humbly pick up, you know, this René Girard theme, you know, the West kind of having gotten lost in individuality and lost the sense of inter-individuality, and this kind of Jamesian notion, which is so beautiful that you're talking about, which I want to just try and kind of feel into, because this is very profound and very deep. This is not a surface dialogue. That when unique self meets unique self, right, what we're talking about is unique self contains within him, contains within her, right? Everything,
that's
the
it.
All. Right?
That's
unique
it.
Self. Unique self is post-true self. Unique self is not the desiccated individual, right, of the modern West who winds up a Gaio Cometti sculpture and ultimately...
You got what I meant.
Alien,
you've heard me, baby. I feel
right,
like
yeah,
you've heard
totally.
Me. That's exactly
unique
what I'm
unique
self
meeting
say.
Here. Right, right, right. In which winds up a Gaio Cometti sculpture. We're totally... And this is it. We're actually doing it. We're incarnating it right now as we talk. And so unique self, right, does is not the individuality of the desiccated separate self-ego. Right? Unique
right.
self... is sitting atop true self. Unique self fully embraces true self, meaning the total number of true selves are one, right? So when Mark and Randall meet as unique selves, we are, on the one hand, true self looking at true self as part of the same profound one, and therefore we have, as you say, and as James says, infinite past together. And we're united deeply in the locus of that one, and yet, we're sparked by this uniqueness, by these unique sparks dancing with each other, right? These unique God sparks, if you will, in the language of the Kabbalah, which inflame
sure.
each other, which enlighten each other. And in that meeting with your uniqueness, right, if I'm moving not from the level of the desiccated individual, which bump into each other are the Hobbesian men at war, but actually, if we meet as genuine, unique selves, then we're holding the whole together. And by looking in your eyes, right, by being, as Levinas would say, based on the biblical verse, right, in both Genesis and Exodus, right, I'm face to face.
Yes.
Right, I'm face to face. And face, of course, is the symbol of two things. Face is the symbol of interiority. The word face in Hebrew that Levinas is translating from, panim, P-A-N-I-M, means to be interior. It's the interior space. And face is also utterly unique, right? The muscles on the face, there are 45 muscles on the face, right, which symbolize uniqueness. They're to express. The facial muscles are about the expression of uniqueness. You can see, you know, 30 backs lined up in a row, and you won't recognize your friend. But if you see 30 faces, you'll recognize your friend immediately, because face is the symbol, right, of unique self. So as two faces meet each other, right, as they spark each other, they meet the whole in the other, and yet at the same time they're meeting uniqueness, meaning they have to be, and this is your gorgeous contribution to this conversation, they have to be open to influence, right? Right? They have to be open
That's
to
it.
Be affected, because, and I think, Randall, this is, I think, just the stunning intuition of what you're saying, and the people who are with us are really the kind of the really deep people who are deep into the Dharma with us here, because if I wouldn't be open to influence, it would mean that uniqueness is a mistake, right?
Yes.
Right? In other words, the entire point of uniqueness is that the divine structure, all that is, right, legislated a world with uniqueness, right, because we need to be influenced. Uniqueness
That's
demands...
Right. If you're standing in the mirror, if
property,
everyone else were
right.
just identical to you, there would be no influence, right?
That's right.
If everyone were identical,
no
influence.
So what uniqueness means is, not only do we require, right, by the very inherent nature of reality, not only do we require relationship, but we require influence. We need to be
That's
influenced
it.
By each other. And
that's
so beautiful, right? And that's really, really where, you know, in our second dialogue, right, we're going to spend like 15 minutes talking about your specific work, but your specific work is really all about influence, No, in a very deep and profound way.
We call it the way of openness. We'll talk about it. Remind me if I don't. We're trying to reduce it to simple terms, and we call it the way of openness, which is influence.
Beautiful.
Both to give influence and to receive it. But we'll talk more about that.
Beautiful. Well, it's been just an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm here with Charles Randall Paul, the president and founder of the Center for Interreligious Diplomacy. And I think everyone sees that, you know, Randall is just a profound man of faith, with just incredible depth, right, in the wisdom traditions of the world, which is not intellectual or abstract depth, but kind of the embodied depth of faith. And so to have been here with you face-to-face has been, for myself, you know, a unique self-experience, and I bow with delight, right, in this wonderful dialogue with you. Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, I namaste to you too, brother.
Yeah, thank you. Awesome.
Thank you
thank
very
you, Randall.
Much. I really enjoyed it.